Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, friends, could you take your seats, please? Do we shut the doors during these sessions or not at the back? Yeah. If somebody could close the door at the back, please. Please take your seats, colleagues. Colleagues and friends, I'm Kevin de Kock. I'm the director of the Department of HIV/AIDS at the World Health Organization in Geneva. And I'm supposed to be co-chairing this session on learning by doing, scaling up HIV operations research in resource-limited settings. I'm supposed to be co-chairing it, either with Dr. George Smitherman, the health minister of the province of Ontario of Canada, but he doesn't seem to be here, so I think we should just go ahead anyway. The purpose of this session is to review the status of HIV operations research globally. We have a replacement. Come along. Welcome. So we have two co-chairs. That's great. So the purpose of the session, which is being this purpose of the session is to review the status of HIV operations research globally, to discuss priority issues for operations research, to discuss strategies and approaches to country level implementation of operational research, and to discuss the importance of building research capacity. The way the session is going to work is I was invited to give a 15-minute introductory presentation, and then we'll hear for about 7 minutes from our distinguished panelists who'll be introduced individually. So if this is okay, without further ado, we'll start. So thanks to the organizers, the World Bank, the Global Fund, the International AIDS Society, and others who've put this important session together. If you Google the Sydney Declaration, you'll likely fall upon an APEC statement that actually refers to energy and climate change. But the other Sydney Declaration was released at the International AIDS Society meeting in Australia a year ago and was a call to arms to invest in research around HIV/AIDS program implementation. And the almost 2,000 signatories of that declaration called on governments and donors to allocate 10% of all HIV resources to research. That's research towards optimizing interventions utilized and health outcomes achieved. And they stated that without such funding, quote, we will fail to maintain a sustained and effective response to the AIDS pandemic, unquote. Over the past year, this call for research to support universal access has ever gotten louder. In a plenary presentation in Sydney, Michel Kazatchkine spoke passionately about operations research, and the fund now encourages countries to include operations research in their applications, with up to 10% of monies in each grant to be allocated to monitoring and evaluation and/or operational research. But such monies are actually rarely, if ever, fully utilized, and operations research always requests and receives less funding than monitoring and evaluation. One should ask, why is this? Research is certainly not a new concept to anyone, although perhaps the term operations research, which is what it's called in North America, South Africa, and Australia, or operational research in Europe and elsewhere, is perhaps less understood. Interestingly, the term actually didn't originate with health, but it arose during the Second World War to address needs such as transporting goods or protecting planes. It's widely used in the military and in business to address questions as diverse as how to more efficiently deploy trucks from a commercial bakery or how to increase sales in a department store. And here's actually a business book on operations research that is actually in its 8th edition. So at an international level, we're trying to increase the attention to operations research, and This publication was released by WHO and the Global Fund a year ago to alert countries to the possibility of including such research in their grant applications and to give some basic guidance. And this week, WHO and the Global Fund are releasing a framework for operations research to guide countries in how to conduct it, shown on the left of the slide, and a publication that joins other documents, for example, the one on the right from the Population Council. PEPFAR held an important consultation in February of this year to discuss so-called public health evaluation, whose essence is operational research applied to PEPFAR-supported program, and deliberately sequenced with that meeting. WHO held a meeting a month later with other agencies examining research aspects relevant to the delivery of ART and care using a public health approach. This unprecedented attention to operational research represents acknowledgement of a dual failure. First, the failure to influence programs directly from the experience of what actually probably amounts to the largest public health program and interventional health experiment that's ever been mounted, treatment scale-up, and second, to draw broader lessons from this extraordinarily rich experience. Now, I use the term failure guardedly. Scale-up represents success, obviously not failure, and it's disrespectful to speak of it in those terms. But I do think that we need to accept that notice has been served, that in the longer term we absolutely must document better and learn better from the billions of dollars of program implementation. And I think happily there is increasing and widespread support for this, but not always clear agreement on the way forward. So a first set of questions might be, well, what is operations research? Are there areas of research we should not be discussing? Exact definitions are difficult, but perhaps like with obscenity or with excellence, we recognize it when we see it, even if we can't define it. Operational research concerns the application of scientific methods and techniques to practical and decision-making problems. It's research to get something done more efficiently. It combines effectiveness with efficiency, a better outcome for a lesser cost, whether the cost be money, time, human effort, whatever. Simply put, operations research is about the science of better. And the choice of camels in northern Kenya to deliver community-based VCT services could exemplify an operational research result to the question of how to assure access in this remote region. So it's applied research focused on specific problems to give specific operational answers. PEPFAR uses its own language, drawing a distinction between public health evaluation, really operations research, and basic program evaluation. And aspects of their definition are that public health evaluations guide program and policy development at the global level, answer big questions, often across countries, but are focused on implementation and are aimed at increasing generalizable knowledge. And this concept of generalizable knowledge, of course, is part of the fundamental definition of research in general. Basic program evaluation, on the other hand, tends to include needs assessment, process evaluations, and some limited outcome evaluations, more limited, more directed at adjusting specific programs in a local area, and unlikely to be of limited value in generating knowledge that really is generalizable. I think basic and investigational clinical research activities are excluded from what we're discussing, or they are in some of the definitions, and country ownership is always emphasized. Now, in this regard of excluding basic and clinical research activities, I think we're far removed from our colleagues working in the field of HIV vaccines or other areas of basic science. In 1994, the late Bernard Fields argued in this very widely cited commentary in Nature from that year that success in AIDS research was more likely to come from encouraging general, non-targeted research than from specific attempts to solve apparent deficiencies such as lack of an AIDS vaccine. Operations research is different in that it's all about making better use of the tools and programs that we have, whether they target prevention, therapy, or care. Investigational clinical research is excluded in the PEPFAR definition, which means that operations research does not encompass clinical trials. I personally think we should reconsider that, at least in some circumstances, for some questions and some research methodologies. A few years ago, a CDC colleague of mine, Barbara Marston, and I wrote an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine on a study claiming that multivitamins slowed the progression of HIV immune deficiency in women in Tanzania not yet on ART. These data were actually derived from a secondary analysis of a trial of micronutrients for a different question. And clearly it demanded being looked at again with a specifically targeted trial. I hesitate to cite another uncertainty in AIDS care, the perennial question of when to start antiretroviral therapy. And you could add questions from prevention, for example, the optimal use of isoniazid preventive therapy for TB, or age-specific impact of male circumcision. Some of these and other questions could potentially be looked at using so-called large, simple trials. Large, simple trials, as their name suggests, are very large in size, involving many thousands, tens of thousands sometimes, are therefore very powerful and are very simple in their randomization design. For example, start early or start late. And they have very hard endpoints, for example, death. And for the use of the endpoint of death, these have sometimes been referred to, perhaps somewhat macabrely, as tombstone trials. I personally argue that we should not on an a priori basis exclude the concept of trials in the context of operational support, operational research scale-up. And actually, to finish this particular comment with an anecdote, a while ago I was talking to the famous British epidemiologist Sir Richard Peto, and actually the doyen of large simple trials, and he asked me whether I thought more trials of male circumcision were likely, and I responded, no, I don't see how those could happen. And he looked at me disdainfully, asking, quote, "For an intervention potentially affecting millions, don't you think we need trials of a few tens of thousands?" End quote. But in the same vein, with 3 million people accessing therapy worldwide, is it really acceptable that decisions on the ideal time to initiate therapy are still based on really personal opinion? I think that with treatment such an important proportion of the $10 billion US dollars spent annually, you think that really we would know. At the recent meeting at WHO, participants identified priority questions relevant to policy within four broad categories: ART, non-ART care, laboratory support, and health systems. And the slide summarizes some of the key questions. For example, how best to retain patients in program, assure adherence, when to start, when to stop, and I won't go through the list. I would remind you, though, that Alex Coutinho, in his very good plenary this morning, referred to the fact that in our programs, certainly in Africa, he cited a figure of one-third of patients not in the program at the end of 2 years. Well, there certainly is a critical question to examine. Of course, the questions extend beyond ART to areas of testing and counseling and HIV prevention. The recently released Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey of 2007, released just a few weeks ago, involved 18,000 persons in 10,000 households and included HIV testing and then CD4 counts amongst those found to be infected. As the pie chart shows, 35% of persons eligible for ART were receiving it, 2% knew their HIV status but were not on ART, but fully 65% of persons HIV infected and eligible for ART did not know their HIV status and thus were not accessing drugs, suggesting actually that the research hypothesis that the single biggest obstacle to universal access today is lack of knowledge of HIV serostatus. And from the same report, fascinating data, you see HIV prevalence in men stratified by age and circumcision status, and how to best scale this up and what the different age implications are would seem an important operational research questions. But defining the boundaries and questions is not enough. How do we assure appropriate oversight without losing timeliness? Identifying a problem and then conducting an appropriate study doesn't lead to translation into action. Indeed, research related to operations research, translation research, is now being discussed. How do we take the findings from operational research and then with little delay implement them broadly? What validation is needed? How do policy and practice actually get changed? I think we'll hear about that from our distinguished panel. So more discussion will be needed, and the relation between research and the development of guidance and guidelines, local, regional, and global. I think another allied area to discuss is that of epidemiologic surveillance and the whole area of strategic information, of which operational research really is a subcomponent. The capacity for public health epidemiology and surveillance in countries is very limited, and there's a huge north-south divide in the quality of public health information available. The capacity to conduct studies and the surveys of the nature of the Kenya AIDS indicator survey I just mentioned also is limited. I think this raises real caution, which we need to discuss. Operational research, I don't think, is just something that can be done without appropriate manpower, capacity, training, and so on. And the justified enthusiasm for moving forward has to be realistic and ensure efficiency and effectiveness. I would challenge you, actually, that it's currently easier, because of capacity, to waste 10% of program's funding than to spend it effectively on research that leads to changes in policy and program implementation. So my point is that we have to be realistic as we move forward. And finally, recognize that the importance of asking the right questions, it's not something that necessarily can be taught. And in this regard, I think we've not been ambitious enough in asking the really big question: what would it take in a high-burden setting to turn this epidemic around? And I cannot help but fear that history will look back and criticize us for timidity and lack of ambition in really deploying everything we have and we know. And I don't know a bigger question for operational research. So the IAS is sponsoring this session to discuss these issues with our panel, from whom you'll hear over the next 75 minutes or so. Moving forward will certainly require coordinated efforts of different partners, global health agencies, funders, research agencies, and countries, to address the precise needs that we identify. The consensus status provided today, and if you don't have it, you can pick it up when you leave the room at the end, is supported by four international partners, the Bank, the Global Fund, the International AIDS Society, and WHO. And it's a step to identifying areas of intervention need, but it doesn't focus on prevention, which obviously will need to be addressed as well. So for the future, I hope, and this is my final slide, I hope that operations research, the science of better, to implement better, will feature prominently in these sorts of meetings, or perhaps even attract its own meeting. And this slide, just for your interest, from the land of Tintin, actually the land of my birth, the land of Mulfrit, and for those Americans in the audience who don't know, but they've just bought Budweiser off you, is again leading the way. Look at the 21st annual conference. But of course, this isn't really truly global. So I thank you for your attention and look forward to the comments of my distinguished colleagues. Now, my co-chair and I are going to have to wing this because we haven't had a chance to speak. So we ask for your indulgence. Perhaps I will take the prerogative of... thank you. Yes. Our first speaker is Dr. Deborah Cotton, Chief Medical Officer of the Clinton Foundation HIV-AIDS Initiative and Director of the Foundation's Center for Strategic HIV Operations Research. She's also Professor of Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and Professor of Epidemiology at the School of Public Health there. Her research concerns the clinical epidemiology of infectious diseases, especially HIV/AIDS, and she's been listed in Best Doctors in America since its inception in 1993. These things haunt you. She's served on numerous committees of the FDA, Antiviral Advisory Committee, has a very extensive CV. She was the recipient of a Distinguished Alumni Award from Boston University School of Medicine. Deborah, we're very pleased to have you. Thank you.
Very much, Kevin. We are being asked to speak for 7 minutes, which when you're an operations researcher feels like a mandate. So I'll try to keep in that timeline. I'm really delighted to be here and to present the work of my colleagues in the Center for Strategic HIV Operations Research at the Clinton Foundation. I think, as most of you know, President Clinton started the foundation in 2002 with the intent of working with governments and other partners to try to dramatically increase the availability of high-quality care and treatment, including, of course, antiretroviral therapy for people in need around the world. We really have three core missions, and CSHORE, the center that I represent, supports all of those missions. First, to negotiate lower costs for tests and treatment, and I think many of you are aware of the statement that was made last week by the President announcing lowered prices for essential malaria treatments. In addition, we've worked to establish major initiatives to enable widespread access to high-quality HIV-related care, and finally, to provide strategic and targeted technical assistance where it is most needed around the world. CHAI, which is the acronym for the foundation, works around the world. We have 22 countries in which the national governments have formal partnerships with us, and an additional number of countries for a total of 69 where we either work directly or where countries have access to CHAI pricing. And this represents availability to more than 90% of people who are currently on treatment. You will see the little red dot that says Quincy, Massachusetts, which is where CSHORE was located. We are now in the historic town of South Boston, Massachusetts, so a little bit closer, if you will, to the actual CSHORE. We are a research team within CHAI, an integral part of CHAI, that was launched in response to direct appeals from governments and others for assistance in resource planning and in allocation. We've been funded by the Gates Foundation with generous funding since 2005. We're all aware, everyone in this room, of how complex health systems are in resource-constrained countries and other settings. Every dollar spent has to be accounted for. We're working in systems that have a shortage of workers, a shortage of facilities, inadequate infrastructure, including roads and clean water. And in all of these settings, we cannot afford any waste, any inefficiency. And the intent of CSHORE is to try to use mathematical models, sophisticated and detailed models, to try to inform the sorts of choices that have to be made with research so that we can have better allocation of these scarce resources. Now, this, of course, is because it's mathematical, involved, and detailed, and I'm sure there are some people in the audience who would like to hear the details about some modeling this afternoon, and others who will be highly relieved that with 7 minutes, that's not possible. But to put it at its simplest, what we try to do is to simulate the effects of proposed interventions and calculate the most efficient ways to distribute and utilize available resources so that we can achieve these better informed decisions and allocations. These can be used in piloting efforts, and they can be used in scale-up efforts. And in a sense, we could look at this sort of modeling as a pilot to pilots. Before we even try to do on-the-ground pilots, can we try to simulate the best way to proceed? This afternoon, I'm going to highlight four areas that we're working in, all of which are going to be presented here at the AIDS 2008 meeting. And these four represent only some of a total of 12 abstracts and presentations that are coming out of CHAI at this meeting. And obviously, I'm going to have to cover a lot of ground very quickly, but would like to, in some ways, just notify you of where we are at the meeting and what you can participate in. We are, first of all, Dr. Meg O'Brien, who chairs our modeling team. On Thursday, we'll be discussing forecasting of ARV product demand using simulation modeling in coordination with WHO and global suppliers. One of the real achievements that we're discussing at this meeting this week is the fact that we do now have wider access. But with that wider access comes a great need to try to predict what we're going to need as things scale up and roll out so that we aren't left with an empty supply chain. And this is actually very difficult and sophisticated modeling and has been a core work of Seashore from the beginning of our existence. Second, on Tuesday, Jennifer Campbell is going to be looking at modeling the financial impact of ART protocol revisions in Botswana. All of us, I think, here are aware of how many governments are adjusting and amplifying their treatment guidelines. In the case of Botswana, treatment guidelines were being developed that were going to have new choices for ARVs for both first and second line therapy, provide therapy for prevention of mother-to-child transmission, and also to provide cotrimoxazole. As these guidelines are developed, it's key to understand what the financial impact is going to be as they're rolled out, and that is the intent of the modeling presentation. The third area that we also have been working in and that will be presented, actually is being presented right now by Jessica Fast, is a project to look at the human resource needs for male circumcision scale-up via time study, and this is in collaboration with partners in Kenya and Zambia. As you know, male circumcision, as many people have alluded to, is a highly effective approach, but we need to really understand the best way to do the procedure in terms of the number of steps, the number of providers, where it can best be delivered, and that's the point of this presentation. And finally, the last session, the reason I'm struggling here is that I'm between my reading glasses and my LASIK with this screen. We need some new breakthroughs in ophthalmology, I think, so I can barely read the screen. We need to also study how to quantify physician time saved, how to task shift. That's been a big topic at the meeting. And on Wednesday, Joyce Chung, who's with us this afternoon, is going to be presenting, speaking on this subject, looking at a project to quantify physician time saved through a pilot simulation in partnership with the government of Rwanda and Family Health International. And I'm going to focus very briefly on that one project. Again, in the interest of time, I won't be able to say much in terms of the modeling. But this is an example of a goal that had been set of 59,000 people on treatment in a clinic by the end of 2008. And at the time the project was starting, half of all the physician time was being utilized for provision of HIV services. The question was, could there be task shifting in such a way that those physicians could be freed up to provide non-HIV care, an essential component of work for that clinic area, for that regional area. And again, we don't have time to go into the modeling, and I hope that you will be able to go to that session, but we were able to show that there could be as much as a 78% decrease in physician demand for HIV services without sacrificing quality or accessibility, and that, of course, is a key component, by shifting tasks to other healthcare workers. And this would free up a substantial amount of time for physicians to be utilized in other healthcare areas. Now, I'd like to end just by talking about a few of the areas of challenge that we have faced. Kevin talked about the many challenges and controversies around operations research, and I'm going to highlight just three. First, I think what we feel the most day-to-day in our work is a lack of comprehensive and reliable data management systems. As you know, data management is a great challenge. It's expensive. It takes a lot of resources itself. And trying to determine how much to invest in these management systems is a critical question for all of us, and one in which we, too, in operations research, feel a great need. Our models can only be as good as the data that we put into them. Another great challenge, which is the price of progress, is that more and more in the HIV treatment community, we're talking about integrating HIV care. Right now, we're talking a lot about integrating HIV and TB care. We're also talking about integrating HIV testing and treatment into care for women from pregnancy through delivery, through caring for children, breastfeeding, diagnosing HIV in those children, and treating. And this kind of integrated care, while absolutely the goal of for all of us, obviously makes models that we do more complex, requires data to be obtained from different sources. We have problems of data gaps, problems of data redundancy, data being collected in different ways in different clinics. And so this has presented quite a challenge for us. Probably the biggest challenge for operations research, Kevin also alluded to, is the fact that the potential for operations research still is not well understood and well appreciated amongst many of our colleagues. And I think that the fact that we're having this session this afternoon is a great step forward to trying to bring operations research to the forefront of the conversation of how we can improve care around the world. So I'm very delighted to have been here today to be able to speak about our work and to invite you again to join us at various posters and oral presentations. I'd like to thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and especially Renee Ridson and Kim Schaefer, who've worked closely with our group, as well as the entire Seashore team, most of whom, again, are based in Boston, some of whom are based permanently in countries, and some of whom are deployed to countries to work on projects. I'd like to especially mention the head of our modeling team, Dr. Meg O'Brien, who's here this afternoon, Elizabeth McCarthy, the head of our policy team, and Sandra Kress, who's the head of our country operations team. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Deborah. I just want to point out, acknowledge that Frank McGee has joined us as co-moderator. Frank is the HIV/AIDS coordinator for the Ontario Ministry of Health in Canada. So he will introduce the last of our, three of the panelists. Thank you, Deborah. That was I thought. Firstly, it's extremely rewarding to see as many people in the room as there are. It was particularly useful, I think, to hear of the potential of operations research in relation to health systems issues. Health systems now, this really dominating global health discussions right now. So thank you for that. It's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Jim Kim. Jim has 20 years or more experience in improving health in developing countries. He was a co-founder of the extremely well-known organization Partners in Health, a nonprofit organization that supports a range of health programs in poor communities worldwide. Jim actually was my predecessor at WHO. He, as the director of the HIV/AIDS department, and before that a special advisor to the late Director General, J.W. Lee. He led the 3x5 initiative and I think deserves extraordinary credit for the operational implementation, the different operational implementation that that program conceived. He's now at Harvard University. He's leading a new initiative in global health delivery designed to discover and share knowledge about effective implementation. Jim received a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, was named one of America's 25 best leaders by U.S. News and World Report, and one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine. Even if you had money, you couldn't pay for this kind of panel. And he has degrees from both Boston and Harvard. And the reason he's limping, despite being a young man, is that he just ruptured his Achilles tendon. And every time I hear that, I have to wince. So thank you for coming, Jim.
Thanks very much, Kevin. Let me start by congratulating Kevin for being the longest-serving director of the HIV department ever at WHO. And let me also apologize for talking you into taking that job for those moments when you wish you hadn't, I'm sure, and I know there must be some. I'll really try to stick to 7 minutes, and I'm going to talk very quickly to try to get through these slides. Everyone knows that this is what we are facing. Cuello de botella, as they say here in Mexico, to refer to traffic jams. That's sort of what we've got. And in this slide, I very, very optimistically put in things like malaria, microbicides, and vaccines that we all hope to have. But even if we have them, the delivery of them, given the current implementation capacity existing in developing countries, will be terribly difficult. So when I went back to Harvard after launching 3x5 with many of my colleagues here, was, all right, so if we wanted to figure out the kinds of health systems, from design to even how you place buildings, the intimate details of how you would construct systems capable of delivering across priorities, HIV, TB, malaria, vaccines, as opposed to a single priority, how would you do it? And I have to tell you that I found very few colleagues in either the medical school or the School of Public Health who were willing to take on that problem. The folks who said, yes, that's what we do every day, were in fact in the business school, at the MIT Systems Engineering Department, at the Kennedy School, places where qualitative and quantitative research together aimed at fixing systems, building systems, that's really where it happened. And if any of you need proof of the fact that that kind of thinking doesn't happen in medical schools, just look at the American healthcare system. So I ended up talking to the doyen of strategy at Harvard Business School. His name is Michael Porter. And he, if any of you have sat through a McKinsey presentation where they give you these buckets and, you know, value chains, Michael actually developed that framework in the 1980s. And it's taught in every business school in the world. And he's all, you know, every year he's mentioned as one of the top two or three most influential business thinkers in the world. And so he kept pushing me and saying, so what is the strategy in global health? And as we went through it, we found, as you all know very well, you know, that you have the average number. When I talk with people who've built good systems and ask them how many other systems they know in detail, the average is about 1.2. They know their own system and bits and pieces of other systems, but don't really think about, you know, I've built this, what is everybody else doing, and how are they solving their problems? So you're working in isolation. Lots of stuff is project-based. And from the perspective of Michael Porter, to do just a gazillion different projects where everyone's making it up as they go is the worst strategy. Competition among implementers, the cottage industry approach of everyone making it up as they go along is exactly what we do in the American healthcare system, so we shouldn't be surprised that we're recreating it in developing countries. So the point that he kept raising to me was, we need a new approach. Now, the lucky thing was that he'd been working on analyzing the American healthcare system, and I kept asking him, so why, Mike, are you studying the American healthcare system? Because he says, because it's the most broken industry I've ever seen, by far. The most customer-unfriendly broken industry. And so, in fact, a whole bunch of people in the Harvard Business School and in the Kennedy School of Government are looking right now at the American healthcare system. So anyway, we got Mike to work with us for the past 18 months to try to figure out an approach to thinking of better strategy and also what it might mean to actually build a field that we started calling global health delivery and that very happily the Gates Foundation started calling that as well. So let's just give you two examples of programs I admire deeply. Tasso and JCRC. Alex Coutinho ran one, Peter Mugenyi ran the other. Two really successful programs in many ways, but their models are totally different. So I went and asked Mark Dybul, so Mark, which is the system design that you recommend? And he said to me, exactly. That's why we're doing public health evaluations, because we need to find out what the differences are. You know, the folks who work in health systems, and I'm very happy to say that the new dean of the Harvard School of Public Health is probably one of the best thinkers in health systems in the world and will lead this project with us, Julio Frank. What he always says is, look, getting to the point of saying these system designs are the ones that will lead to your best outcomes, that is the holy grail. We're not there yet. And so in these particular cases, when I asked Mark, you know, in terms of operational details, which is the one you recommend? When I spoke with Alex, when I spoke with Peter, what we learned is that Alex has done fantastic stuff in reaching people in remote areas, motorcycle riders, community health workers. They're very much based on what they know. They're a community-based organization. Peter has really revolutionized access to laboratory services, you know, in remote areas of Uganda, but very different models, and we've got to come to terms with it. So what we've started to do, and again, in collaboration with the business school, the Kennedy School, with the MIT Systems Engineering Department, we've started what we call our Global Health Delivery Project. You know, the point is we've got to systemize the study of delivery, and we've got to do it with more than epidemiologists and physicians, the usual suspects in our world. We need informed policy decisions, and we need to rapidly diffuse innovations. And it turns out that there's a lot of new methods that can help us a lot. But what Porter and the systems engineers keep saying is, you've got to get the data on what people are actually doing. Managers ask a very straightforward question. What did people do? And when you see some of these clinical outcome studies that we see comparing, say, breastfeeding to infant formula, and you ask the other question, so what was the background implementation capacity and what were they doing that led to these particular outcomes. We often don't have that kind of information. And I think in the medical world, we're scared of that because it's qualitative information. Information that's used every day in business and in other industries, but that we've been scared of. So I borrow this slide from Tim Evans. If randomized controlled trials are the gold standard for clinical medicine, what do we have for scale-up of health systems, in this case, using HIV money? And it turns out there's quite a bit. And to take on Kevin's point of clinical trials, well, in the area of health systems development, I think Julio Frank did the most interesting work recently by using randomized evaluation to take advantage of the stuttering of the rollout of the insurance program here to actually get randomized-looking data by comparing groups that got the intervention to groups that were going to get the intervention 12 to 18 months later. These new methods are being now utilized in a lot of the world of economics, and I think we can do as well. Mike Porter said, and again, getting back to Kevin's point, so what would you do? What are all the things that you would do if you wanted to really deliver as much value as possible for a population over time in HIV? And so we actually took the time to look at prevention and all the stages of delivery. And, you know, you might pay $500,000 to McKinsey to do this, but we did this ourselves for much cheaper under the tutelage of the guy who came up with the value chain, which is another point. I think this work can't sit only in the consulting groups. I think this has to be a field because we in academia are much better at sharing than the consultancy groups. So what do? We wrote 10 cases under the tutelage of the systems engineers, 15 now, under the tutelage of the systems engineers and the business professors to try to figure out what happened in things like the Iran's Triangular Clinic program, the 100% condom use program, a Rwandan example in terms of HIV treatment. And every time we looked, we were surprised. The details were really interesting and important. And when we looked at it with and from the perspective of systems engineers and business specialists, they said, you know, there's some really interesting things that we see in other great industries that they did here. And we see some classic mistakes that they could have avoided. So we teach a course now entirely case-based. Bill Rodriguez, my colleague, is in the room. That's been very popular. We have a whole new round of cases to go. And along with WHO and 9 other universities, we've started a project focused on trying to figure out how to harness the power of global health initiatives for health system strengthening. And so let me briefly just say, if you're going to really do something that gets you all the way from the beginnings of gathering data of what people are doing all the way to better implementation, one of the most important things I've learned is you need a lot of unusual suspects. You need systems dynamic specialists, which, by the way, are different from systems engineers who do optimization. I didn't know that. And you need people who study strategy, and the operations research is part of the whole spectrum. But if you really want to get at something as complex as building the kind of healthcare systems that can deliver across priorities, you've got all of this. Now, I'm all out of time. And let me just do this really briefly. I think there's a lot of things we can do to get at this question of how to harness the power of the HIV money for health system strengthening. We got to get existing data. We have to build a case library that we share with each other where we get at the details of what people have actually done, frameworks for investigation. I think the power of the Internet is extraordinary. We can build communities of practice so people are constantly talking to each other about the details of delivery. And finally, we have to make this stuff immediately practical and useful. That's what the business folks do. They say, all of my scholarship has to either be immediately useful to practitioners or I have to leave the academy. Thank you very much.
thank you very much, Jim. Our next speaker is Lydia Mungerera. Lydia worked from 1986 to 1997 in Southern Africa as a senior medical officer in different positions. She tested positive in 1998 and returned to Uganda to join the network of people living with HIV/AIDS, doing capacity building, fighting stigma, treatment literacy, human rights work, and so on. She founded the Uganda Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS, which developed training programs for employees in the workplace and worked with employers to develop workplace programs. And she also was heavily involved in antiretroviral drug policy and implementation in Uganda. Since 2007, she's the health policy advisor. She's the Health Policy Advisory Committee Director in the Ministry of Health to represent civil society in the area of HIV/AIDS. And she's also joined the National Advisory Committee on PMTCT in Uganda. Lydia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Just a little correction. I actually don't work in the Ministry of Health. I work for TASO, but I sit on the Health Policy Advisory Committee just as a member, representing civil society. I was given a huge task, actually, the role of people living with HIV/AIDS in operational research and to look at the African perspective. First of all, I'd like to thank the researchers and WHO especially for inviting me to give this presentation, because most of the times these presentations are given by researchers. But I think it's very important to involve people living with HIV/AIDS who do have some experience in research and can give the feelings and how we can work together as partners. I just want to give a small background. GIPA, this was launched in, declared in 1994. And it's a greater involvement of people living with HIV/AIDS. And then I wanted to say that people living with HIV/AIDS networks have learned skills to reach out to the communities. They're the best placed to reach out to communities. Community awareness about research is best done by people living with HIV/AIDS and best placed to monitor ethical protocols, care, treatment, and follow-up of research participants. The need for adequate, correct information on the objectives and expected outcome of research is necessary for people living with HIV/AIDS, and we've had a lot of examples of where things have gone wrong, where people living with HIV/AIDS have got together and they've been told that there's a research going on, and they've heard from people who are coming from research the wrong messages, and we think that it's very necessary to involve them right from the beginning. And knowing how well these networks are at sensitizing communities and getting close to them, probably they could be the best people to discuss ethical protocols with them in other settings. The need to monitor comprehensive care, support, and treatment during and after research is very important. I just want to give a few recommendations coming from previous experience. We've always discussed in our networks that if we could be given the chance to form research networks, that would help us reach out to communities and let them know about research which is going on in our countries and research which is going on in other countries. And we think of monitoring and evaluation of operational research should involve people living with HIV/AIDS networks. This, what we mean is that we know that there needs to be monitoring and evaluation of what goes on in country and in our clinics and in our centers. But we think that networks of people living with HIV/AIDS should be involved right at the beginning. And involvement on research advisory committee should not be tokenism. There have been committees put in place and people have been invited as partners to join these committees. But without being involved right from the beginning in planning this research and looking at research priorities from us, our side, I think it's very important to involve them meaningfully. And I just want to give a few examples. I've been involved in a research for the last 2 years called the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and HIV/AIDS. And Jim Kim and myself co-chair one of the learning groups. And I think this is one example of a research which has involved myself right from the beginning in planning, in how we should run the research, in the research priority, in how to come out with a good report. And I'm really grateful to the Joint Learning Initiative for doing that. Training in research skills should be made available for us. As you know, many of us, some of us are scientists, but a big chunk of our lives was taken up in falling very sick, in getting better, in rehabilitating, getting back to work. And so we didn't have the chance to go out and learn these research skills. And we think we need to be given this chance to train and learn these skills so that we can join our fellow researchers in doing this research. And I think more resources are needed for operational research, especially in Africa. I was also asked to look at research being done in Africa from our side. I think we all know about Africa having the highest burden of the epidemic, and especially bearing the feminine face. Women are faced with heavy burdens of orphan care and looking after orphans and vulnerable children. And I think many research has been done in many clinical settings in Africa. And it has offered opportunities for treatment, care and support for people living with HIV/AIDS. And we've had a lot of research done in Uganda, for example, where I come from. And during this research, we know that many of our colleagues and our fellow sufferers from this virus have actually managed to be put on antiretroviral therapy. And we are very grateful for that. And funding for operational research in Africa has increased over the years. Look, I want to look a little bit at the gender issues. I also belong to networks of the international community of women who live with HIV. And we have sat down a lot and discussed trials and research done on women. And these are a few things I want to say. That when you come to Africa, women are not decision makers where their bodies are concerned, where their lives are concerned. Men actually are the decision makers for most women. And most women are not educated and should be given opportunities to learn these skills. And I think there should be involvement of positive women. As positive women, we are saying that if there's any research going on which concerns us, I think we should be involved, especially in determining some of the research priorities. And I think all operational research should be carried out in a gender-sensitive manner. And knowing that we are not the decision makers in the homes, we must realize that there is gender-based violence. When we did go out and decide that we want to have this research, we can agree to be participants, and somebody goes back home and the husband asks her, her partner asks her, what on earth were you doing going to agree to be in part of that research? And that's why you find there's a lot of stigma, and women hide the fact that they are involved in research. Now, from the African perspective, I took out a few points. I think African researchers should be supported. Like I've already said that for people living with HIV/AIDS, but I think for African researchers, they should be supported to go out and learn further research skills. And I think operational research in Africa should consider the cultural, gender, and social dynamics of the African setting, which is very different from many other parts of the world. Research priorities should be determined with involvement of the African researchers. Because sometimes research does come to Africa, but if you don't involve, if it's not having the African researchers looking at these are the priorities and we think we should do it this way, and you know, looking at our own, the way that we live our lives in Africa, sometimes there are repercussions. I think there should be more research in the area of children. Of late, we come to realize that there's been a large gap. And I think the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and HIV/AIDS has provided us with that opportunity to go and look at what can we do to help, what is lacking, where are the gaps in the area of addressing the growing concern of children affected by HIV/AIDS. And I think we need more research done. And I think results from research done by African researchers should be honored. I've taken this from somebody mentioned this when I went to Geneva for a WHO meeting in gaps in research, and we had somebody from Senegal who said that sometimes the research coming from Africa is not recognized. And I think this is what I meant by this particular statement. These are my only few slides I wanted to give to present in 7 minutes. And I want to just acknowledge the AIDS Support Organization, which has given me so much support, because I really do go out and join research committees, and I'm involved in research. And my networks, I can't forget my networks, people living with HIV/AIDS, GNB+, ITPC, ICW, and PASAM. And WHO for always inviting me to be part of research meetings, and of course the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and HIV/AIDS, who have taught me so much that I didn't know before. Thank you.
I'm going to make it up to my co-chair for being late by reminding our last two speakers that we're trying to stick to the time frame. So our next speaker is Dr. Vonthanek Safoun. He was recruited in 1995 to the National Center for HIV/AIDS, Dermatology, and STDs, where he took on the responsibility of the HIV surveillance program that achieved recognition as one of the most comprehensive in the Asian region. Dr. Safoon then went on to study epidemiology at UCLA in 1999 and returned in 2003 as the first Cambodian to graduate with a PhD in this discipline. He was named as head of the research unit at the NCHADS. In early 2004, he was appointed as the vice director to the Cambodian National Institute for Public Health. He is the founder of the first school of public health in Cambodia, which just opened to students last year. He has also been principal investigator and co-investigator on several national scale surveys, clinical trials, and epidemiological studies.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I would like to thank the organizer for inviting me here. And I have to admit that it's a very difficult task for me to have a presentation after all world-famous presentation. But what I'm going to talk about is the obstacle to operational research and some proposed way forward. And again, the organizer have asked me to give a perspective from Asia perspective. So first, in the first few slides, I will focus on different factors that I think are the obstacle to conduct operation research in resource-limited setting. First factor is the human factor. The human factor is the main and the first factor that I consider and presented here. And those factors are lack of appropriately trained personnel. And this is a major chronic problem in resource-limited setting. And on top of that, not only limited number of trained personnel in research, but also we have intra and international migration of those researchers. This is another chronic problem called brain drain in our country. Internal brain drain and external brain drain. And the root causes that I listed here are the two main root causes for the brain drain in the country. One is lack of nationally coordinated career path. So, for example, a researcher graduated with a degree from a developed world returned back to their own country and are not able to have a clear career path. Somebody got a degree in epidemiology and later on worked in a management area and worked on a field that is not related to epidemiology. It's a major issue here. And the second root cause is lack of enabling research environment. This include incentive, this include infrastructure, including laboratory capacity to conduct research. And these are the factor that very much involved in human factor. I would like to move to the second factor called institutional structure here. Lack of national coordinating body for health research system as a whole, and in this particular case, is the health operation health research is the major issue. We do not have coordinating body for this health research system, and due to the lack of the coordinating body, we do not have a research agenda, an operation research agenda for the country. And another main problem is the lack of credibility in conducting research, or not only conducting, but publishing or reporting research. And the previous speaker also touched on this. The third point is political advocacy. We know that in developing setting, and especially Cambodia setting, we know there is a weak link between policymaker and researcher at the country level. So there are research, a limited number of research conducted in the country, but the result of the research finding was not, fully used by the policymaker in the country. One way or another, there are several reasons. If we want to explore, there are, a number of reasons why the research funding are not channeled or are not used by used by the policymaker. And another major point is the lack of cohesive political advocacy at the national level. And also, this is also true from our perspective at the international level. And Another factor that I consider as obstacle to conducting operation research in developing countries is lack of funding. I look at two scales. One is the national budget. As you all aware, you are aware that, you know, in developing countries, we have in the national budget for health, we have so many competing priorities, and funding for research need to be perceived as an investment rather than spending. But that is not the case. And on top of that, to make things even worse, the international health research grant are caused through scientists and institutions from developed countries. So we do not have funding from national budget to conduct research. So we depend on developed world to help us to conduct research. But what we are facing is something that I quote here. What you are interested in is not in the scope of my interest. Please go to another donor and find someone who, you know, match your interest. Last one but not least, and the most important one, is community role. The problem here that we consider as obstacle is the lack of experience on how to involve community in biomedical research. And this relationship is a very new and very delicate relationship between researcher and community. And some research project and research activity can easily be politicized. And you can get these examples from different countries. The third one is community participation in research. Everyone talk about community participation. Everyone talk about community role. But community participation in research is vaguely defined. These are all the obstacles that we perceive as the obstacle for operation research in developing in resource-limited setting. And the next slide, I would like to present some proposed way forward. One, and the most important one, is building and retaining health workforce for research in the country. I think so far there has been effort from the developed world to help to build health workforce for research. However, the major issue is to build and retain, help us to retain, so that we have a critical mass of researchers in developing countries. And how can this be done? We need both individual support to researchers returning to the developing world and institutional support. Two, promote approach to bridge the gap between producer and user of research. And the user research here, it can be on both ends, policymaker and the community. Third one is to promote greater coherence and coordination among funder, researcher, and policymaker at the national level, if this is not possible yet at the international level. Fourth point, establish, or if already exists, strengthen the national health research system. The fifth one is to encourage equal and transparent partnership, north to south and south to south collaboration. I think we don't ask for more. We don't ask for a south-led research project. We ask for an equal and transparent partnership for the collaboration between north and south or south and south. Six, define community involvement in health research. We talk a lot about it, but let's define it. I think this is the last slide. Thank you very much for your attention.
Our last speaker is Dr. Deborah Zaudi. She received her PhD in immunology from the University of London and was a senior MacArthur Fellow at Harvard University School of Population and Development Studies. She has published numerous journal articles and book chapters on a variety of public health subjects. Dr. Zaudi is currently director of the World Bank's Global HIV/AIDS Program, where she provides overall strategic and technical leadership to the bank's AIDS efforts. She serves as the bank's UNAIDS Global Coordinator and represents the institution as a member of the UNAIDS Program Coordinating Board, contributing to the development and implementation of global HIV policies and strategies. There's a lot more achievements listed here, but Dr. Zaudi asked me to be brief.
She doesn't like long introductions.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Let me start by recalling Sydney in July last year, where many of us endorsed the declaration calling for 10% of all resources dedicated to HIV programming to be used for research towards optimizing interventions utilized and health outcomes achieved. The context of the Sydney Declaration was an unprecedented increase in total annual resources for AIDS for both international and domestic sources. That context has not changed. Finances available reached $10 billion last year, and we applaud further substantial commitments that were recently made by the U.S. government. This increase in funding has made possible a rapid scale-up of access to treatment, alleviating resources and capacity constraints to put nearly 3 million people on antiretrovirals. But has the situation changed for the funding of research? The Sydney Declaration calls for 10%. This financing scenario would mean $1 billion available per year. The reality remains far from that ideal target, and the collective amount allocated to research are closer to 0.1 billion. These figures were gathered by the World Bank from three major donors and do not address treatment specifically, but look at proportional allocations to research overall. I would note also that the almost 40 million reported by the World Bank covers both research and administration, and research has the minor component of this. What is highlighted here is the fact that despite dramatically increased commitments for HIV programs, resources allocated to research by the three major funding agencies are insufficient. A closer look at the figure shows that even where funds are specifically made available for research, such as in the case of the bank and the Global Fund, they are often not used because funding agencies have not directly tackled the systematic constraints to research. In the systematic impediments to research that the World Bank is working with partners in trying to address, one mechanism has been through the support of a network of treatment researchers from resource-limited settings. This small group of researchers from Africa, South America, and Eastern Southern Asia met for the first time in Sydney, along with partners from the World Health Organization, the International AIDS Society, the research-based pharmaceutical industry, academia, the US NIH, and others. The network was asked to identify from the perspective of local researchers working with treatment programs in resource-poor countries. Research needs that were A, of direct relevance to treatment operations, and B, currently unfunded by existing programs and agencies. After much consultation, the group arrived at a short list of questions most needing to be addressed and identified. Two, as they highlight the priority. Number one, research to improve the durability of first-line regimens. And two, research on selecting the best second-line regimen and when to switch to it. Both these topics were given to members of the network to take forward and construct a research proposal that would best answer these pressing operational questions. These research proposals were presented as concept notes for discussion at the two-day consultation organized in March of this year by the World Health Organization, which we have heard about from Kevin and many others. With the other co-sponsors of the meeting, the World Bank has committed to advocate for increased funding for operations research to inform treatment programming and implementation of the priority activities identified during the consultation, including the operations research proposals from the network. Collaboration with countries and partners to promote a research agenda and research capacity. How will the World Bank support this specifically? We will work guided by two important principles. Firstly, the division of labor among the UNAIDS co-sponsors, which tasks the World Bank with supporting strategic planning, monitoring and evaluation. Secondly, the president of the World Bank's strategic team, knowledge and learning, using the bank's experience for better development outcomes. The program will also support policy-relevant analytical work, including operations research, contribute to the development of national research agendas, and aim to make impact evaluations an integral part of ongoing bank programs. In this way, countries can make more use of bank resources for research. Therefore, while the World Bank Global HIV/AIDS Program will continue to assist countries with strategic planning and monitoring and evaluation for their national AIDS responses, the program is also committed to expanding our work to generate evidence for formative policy development as an integral part of this assistance. Additionally, the Global HIV/AIDS Program supports small, targeted operations studies either in response to a request by government or to shed light on particular policy questions. For example, in Lesotho, we are assisting the Ministry of Health in assessing the efficacy and cost-effectiveness of their village health worker program in delivering ART. In Haiti, with local partners like JESCO and Cornell University, we are assessing the impact of the recent food crisis on patients' ability to continue their ART-interrupted research, with potentially very broad implications for countries with large treatment programs where food security is an issue. We are also assisting the Ministry of Health of Cambodia with an impact evaluation of their innovative work in increasing access to PMTCP services. So, with this as background, where do we go from here? We have an identified target for funding that many have endorsed. We have a broad consensus that massively expanding treatment programs should no longer be left unguided by operations research, and we have come a long way, especially with the hard work of the World Health Organization towards identifying specific priority research that needs support. How will that support be delivered? Currently, there are clear mechanisms for assessing project finance and for health systems strengthening. Through its recently released new health strategy, the World Bank has brought partnership for health system support to the front and center of its agenda. But consider a policymaker in a country faced with who needs to conduct operations research to guide this programming. To whom does she or he currently turn for assistance? As we conclude this session and continue our discussion, I call on all our partners to work together to answer these critical questions. How can we better support operations research through our existing programs? Do we need an entirely new mechanism for financing operations research that we can contribute to jointly? What might such a mechanism look like? How can we ensure that our efforts to support research are coordinated and that the important operations lessons learned are shared? Once again, I would like to congratulate the World Health Organization, the International AIDS Society, the Global Fund, and all our partners for moving this important agenda forward. Congratulations also to the researchers working in countries upon whose hard work and dedication our future success so heavily depends. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Deborah Work. Thank you to all of the speakers. We have about 15 minutes for discussion, questions, comments, and at the end, perhaps we could open it up, and then I'll ask Frank to close the session at 2:15, if you keep an eye on the time. So perhaps go to the microphone and, And try and, if everybody could just say who you are, where you're from, and try and keep your questions and comments relatively brief. And
I'm Susie Foster from Boston University School of Public Health. One of the questions, I've been doing some work in Uganda, and one of the questions that keeps coming up over and over on the treatment side is, where are the men? And this is the group I've been working with, particularly a patient sample of 1,400 approximately. 71% are women. So I'm wondering, and it's a TASO group in Jinja. So I'm just wondering, where does that figure on the grand scheme of operations research in terms of finding out, is it that there are fewer men with HIV, or where are they?
Thank you very much for saying that. Actually, even people, clients who come to TASO, we always ask where are the men, because 70%, almost 70% of our clients are women. And when you ask the women tell you that that men don't want to hear about this. There's still a lot of stigma and denial amongst our African men, and it's not only in TASO or in Uganda. So I think there should be an area of research. ECPAF did some work in Uganda, looking at PMTCT and wondering why do women come alone to the clinics and where are the men? And there are a few. They came out with a few points one of the things was that even the services were not male friendly and it was not a tradition, so it was not taken at that, and there were no programs for them. But I think we need to go out in the community to get the men. There needs to be more community sensitization, and as you say, we need to have some research done on what are the best ways we can use to engage men. But I think we need to get them from the community and find out. Thank you.
Thanks. Ian?
I'm not Ian Weller from the United Kingdom. I'm not sure who to address this point to, but I leave that to you, Chairman. But Von Thanek and Deborah touched on this, and I think it's a really important issue, that whilst the Sydney Declaration is asking the program donors to contribute to research, how do we influence northern government research bodies, the people that we traditionally turn to for research, to adopt this type of research and fund it?
Jim, do you want to have a...
You know, we've been asking this question of the National Institute of Health, and we've put it this way. We've put it this way. How crazy is it to have a National Institute of Health at $30 billion a year, where you focus, if you look at the Gates Foundation designation on discovery, upstream research, and the development of new tools, and then think that delivery will happen automatically? That's how it's structured. So we just had a conversation 2 weeks ago with the two senators and said what we need is a robust National Institute of Healthcare delivery that puts billions of dollars. Now, you know, there are different ways to do it. ARC, the Agency for Health Research on Quality, is at $300 million and they get the crap beat out of them all the time if they really critique, for example, the practice of spinal surgeons. So we have to find a way to find new funding for delivery and just, you know, accept the fact that no matter how much you do discovery and development, you know, in the United States, the gap is 17 years between the availability of a product and getting it to everyone who needs it. I think that you know, in the United States anyway, the costs are so high, the outcomes are so bad, that the pressure to do that will be very high. I think the UK does it a lot better, you know, than the US, but we're working on that.
Jim Forright, Population Council. I'd like to make just an observation. We had two methods represented, case studies and mathematical models. And operations research really deals with problems, and it's problem-driven rather than methods-driven. And so many, many different disciplines can contribute. Experimental psychologists, sociologists, economists, anthropologists. We've had all of these working in our OR programs. The other thing is that the substance of operations research is programs. And it's really, really valuable for an operations researcher to have had some first-hand program experience, whether as a provider or an evaluation officer or an education officer or what have you. And that gives them an immediate connection to the problems that they're working with and insights that you usually don't get with people just out of graduate school. Thank you.
So, thank you. I think that's a comment more than...
We agree.
Hi, I'm Allison Spensley with the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. I think we all agree that increasing operations research is incredibly important, but I'm just wondering if there has been discussion around avoiding duplication of efforts as the increasing funding, as the funding increases, and we hopefully are doing more and more, and I don't know if that's been discussed.
Deborah Work, do you want to take that?
Ms. Deborah? Thank you.
I've not said Deborah Work. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's a sign of how far women have come. I've never been on a panel with another Deborah.
I've never dealt with that.
I've said Deborah Work, but Deborah, please. Deborah Work first, if you have something to add.
Thank you, Kevin.
World Bank Deborah. The one with the money.
True. Thank you. What we did when we met in Sydney with a number of researchers from different countries in the world is, at least what came out of it, which I tried to allude to in my presentation, did not point to duplication, which showed that whatever we are doing up to now is very much limited. So I wish we had the kind of problem that you are alluding to, but it's so abysmally small at the moment, I don't think we are there. What we need to do, however, as we accelerate and expand this, is to avoid exactly what you said. Another thing which I want to mention is at the beginning of this epidemic, for those of you who have been old enough, research was categorically discouraged, especially by funding agencies, because the money was supposed to go to programs, as if research does not inform programs. So it is a pendulum where we have come from that extreme to where we are now. And currently, frankly, there is very little operational research which is informing programs so that we can get results rather than duplication.
A micro sentence from Dr. Chin. Jim Kim.
You know, I would just say that if you look at the basic science world, there's tons of duplication. People going after and trying to solve the same problems. I would love to see the day when we actually have duplication and people are trying to answer a similar question in different places. But what I would say is I think WHO has to play a role. I think that if you look at how people communicate with each other these days, Facebook, MySpace, you can create a community of practice among operations researchers, and that we would know very well the kinds of things we're taking on. But I think it's okay to have a little bit of duplication. What a great day that would be.
Okay, I think we have probably about 7-8 minutes left, so let's try and move through as many as possible and answers as well. And I'm going to ask some of the speakers who haven't answered yet. Please.
My name is Vuman Magezi. I'm from South Africa. I can identify with what Dr. Safone and the rest of the team has spoken about concerning research, especially from African perspective, where you lack career path and resources. However, that's not my question. My question is, why is the panel here flooded only by people from medical profession, especially when we're talking of operational research? Obviously, there are other people who are involved in health anthropology who would bring a special dynamic to the whole understanding of the epidemic from ecosystematic perspective, which is not represented here.
Okay.
And maybe let me finish. Then linked to that, then I think is a lack of reflection on the understanding of the community structure in terms of its input and involvement in medical understanding, which a speaker alluded to.
I'm an anthropologist.
Deborah, do you want to have a go at that?
I think it's an excellent question and statement, and I would like to say, in the interest of time, I wasn't really able to talk about the expertise within my own group, but in fact, I believe I'm the only physician, and we have people who have backgrounds in epidemiology, including PhDs, biostatistics, management, economics, public health, but I absolutely agree that operations research is hopefully not going to be a sort of hierarchical field. One of the beautiful things about new fields is that people can populate it from all different backgrounds, and I had the opportunity in my own life of watching my husband, who is a PhD pure mathematician, go into computers early on and watch all the different people with different backgrounds who populated that field and just made tremendous advances. So I would love to see that happen in operations research.
Thank you. Wafa.
Wafa El Sadr, ICAB, Columbia University. Thank you very much. This is a very important area, and thanks to all the presenters. I guess I've been thinking that there's actually a lot that's happening when you think about it. I think in terms of monitoring and evaluation, there's been an enormous efforts put in building systems on the ground at facility levels and at all levels in order to collect information. Enormous training of individuals on the ground as well. You know, at all levels, from the facilities to the districts to the ministries of health. And unfortunately, I think it would be unfortunate if we separate the information that's available to us through the monitoring and evaluation systems and how this information can guide in a very dynamic way how programs are shaped day to day. And certainly I agree with the need for clinical trials and the need for operations research, but I do believe that we might be missing a very large opportunity to utilize the data we have and to really build the feedback systems. We're trying to do that through the programs that ICAP supports in trying to develop systems that take the data that's collected and then bring it back to the people who actually collected the data so they can use it to inform the program and build better programs. And I think we need to do that in a very dynamic manner. So while we're waiting for the funding of the large operations research studies. Okay.
Dr. Safon, you want to comment?
All I can say is I totally agree with your comment. You know, monitoring and evaluation is, you know, is a major component that exists already in the current system, and we have to make best use of the system that will go hand in hand with operation research.
We're going to run out of time. I'm going to try something I've never tried before. We have four or five people waiting. Could you ask your question in one sentence?
Yes.
One after the other, and then we'll see whether the panel can give an answer in a very staccato fashion, and I'm going to hand it over to Frank.
How will the predictable development of a rapid genotype, a limited sensitivity rapid genotype assay, be integrated into operation considerations, and how would it change operations within the context of what we're talking about? And finally, what's stopping that from occurring?
You mean the HIV genotype assay?
A rapid HIV genotype, phenotype, a rapid HIV resistance test. How do we integrate it? What's stopping it from being integrated? And how do we develop it?
Thank you. Next. Say who you are.
Nduku Kilonzo, Liverpool VCT Care and Treatment Kenya. Translating research to policy has been said to be subjective. Do we have any frameworks or guidance on strengthening or enhancing objectivity, or is there any acceptable methodology or some guidance on methodology?
Bert Houts, I'm with BD, a medical technology company based in the U.S. Question is, why don't we see more public-private partnerships between pharma and in-country research programs to develop good clinical laboratory practices in terms of developing SOPs for developing clinical trials?
Thank you. This seems to work. Should try this more often. People don't talk so much.
Hi, I'm Raj Punjabi from Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. In Liberia, where we work, we're often challenged not by policymakers or the communities we work with around an HIV treatment program. When we do operations research, we're challenged by epidemiologists who say what we're doing is not true science, and it's irresponsible to use that to convince policymakers to channel resources one way or another. So my question to the panel is, how important do you think that challenge is going to be for the OR agenda moving forward to claim legitimacy and credibility within the medical scientific establishment?
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, very quickly then. Deborah Work from the World Bank. Genotype assay, yes or no?
Absolutely, why not? It's available, but I don't think that's the issue. The issue is how do we make the most use of what is already available and to have more people access treatment, which is available in many of the settings.
And lab support's covered in the documents as priority issues. How to
public-private partnerships. Who would like to tackle that one? Deborah, do you have...
Well, I would welcome public-private partnerships. I think we're beginning to see them. I think that it's tough for private industry to feel that they understand and can get their hands around operations research as it has been for various academic guilds. So I think certainly we are beginning to have a lot of interest and inquiries from pharma and other groups, and I really hope that we can see a change. I think it is very important.
Jim, methodology?
Yeah. So the greatest social science, quantitative social scientist at Harvard is named Gary King, and he says, look, all studies are qualitative. Some of them have numbers. In other words, we're all working with some idea of what the hell's going on here. And so I'm working very closely with Chris Murray at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, and he puts it this way. We've got a lot of data that looks at relationships, and we seem to know what's working and what's not working, the what, but what we don't know is the how and the why, and the only way to get that is by doing qualitative research. And for the people who say it's not real science, at Harvard, Raj, what I would say is, well, then please go and tell President Drew Faust, who's an historian, that the entire body of her work is useless.
Perhaps I can make the final comment to that. The definition of operational research I really did like was the science of better, which is, I guess, how I would answer the question about is it science. Thanks a lot. Frank, over to you.
Just before closing, I've been asked to announce two other sessions that will happen this week on the same topic. One is tomorrow between 11 and 12:30. It's a skills-building session on practical steps to successful operation and integration research. That is in Skills Building Room 3. And on Wednesday at 1,800 hours and 30 minutes to 2,000 hours and 30 minutes, a satellite sponsored by the ANRS and WHO on scaling up operational lessons from research in Africa. So on behalf of my co-chair, I'd like to thank the IAS for putting together this workshop, and of course, thank all our panels for their presentation today. Thank you.